Mentoring Solutions Proprietary Limited does not hold an Australian financial services license and does not purport to offer or provide financial advice. The information contained in this recording does not constitute specific financial, accounting, tax, legal, or other similar type advice. We strongly recommend that you liaise with your own financial, legal, accounting, and other advisors to ensure that the concepts contained herein can be tailored to your specific needs. Mentoring Solutions Proprietary Limited does not accept liability for any loss, damage or expense incurred by you if you rely on or utilise any of the methods, techniques or ideas discussed within this recording.
Hi and welcome to today's special webinar on Money Partners. I'm Simon Buckingham, joined today in the webinar studio by Brendan Kelly.
Pleased to be here.
Now, this is going to be the first of a two-part webinar series on the topic of Money Partners and Joint Venture Partners. The simple truth is that no matter how experienced as an investor you become, sooner or later you're going to max out on your own capacity. Either because you're just taking on more and more or larger and larger deals and you just hit a point where the bank turns around and goes, you know what, you're fully committed at the moment, so no more for you, or all of your cash is committed into the costs like deposits or project costs that you need to contribute to for the deal. And that's going to happen. That's just reality. Unless you're quite relaxed about the pace of your investing and you're just going to do one deal at a time in sequence, release your capital, release your borrowing capacity, go again. If you want to really accelerate your investing and get into multiple simultaneous deals or hold a multi-property portfolio and still do other deals as well, you are going to max out from time to time. Today, some of the things we want to go through are when you ought to be looking for money partners or JV partners. What are money partners and JV partners? How do they differ? What's the difference between a money partner and a joint venture partner? And then we'll spend the bulk of the remainder of the webinar talking about how you go about finding potential partners. And we'll provide some suggestions around that, look at some approaches that have been suggested by other people, maybe pull those apart, put them back together, and talk about what's worked for us. In the next webinar on this topic, we'll look more at the commitment side. How do you, once you've found the potential partner, how do you really get them to commit to the deal that you want to do? And some of the critical success factors that we'll go into around what makes a money partner or a JV partnership work. All right, let's start at the beginning. Brendan, when should people decide that they want to go looking for money partners or joint venture partners?
Oh, firstly, when you identify that you don't have the cash to do the deal yourself. So, for example, you have come across a scenario where you found a deal, you can see the profit in it, you go to the bank and they say no. Or if you do an assessment on your own financial circumstances, you say, these are limitations of what I can buy, and you find that it's not enough for you to get into the size of deal that you're after for the profit that you want to seek. So you either at that point choose to do smaller deals and take a lot longer, or eventually or potentially get into some sort of JV or money partner agreement that allows you then to follow through on the visions that you had originally. Now, when do you actually start to look for JV money partners? Well, in the process of investing, there are two games you have to play almost simultaneously. The first game is finding the deal. And the second game is finding the partner who's going to fund the deal with you, the JV partner or the money partner. Now, if you spend all of your energy finding a deal and you come up with a deal and you think this is a great deal, and then you start to look for a money partner, the pressure's on to find cash really quickly.
So let's say you found a deal, and even if you tie it up under a conditional offer, say, oh, I've got 2 weeks due diligence or 2 weeks subject to building and pest and finance and whatever clauses else I put in there, those 2 weeks come and go. If I haven't found a money partner or a JV partner to help me into that deal, what's my option?
You either have to let the deal go or you're in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, take a heck of a risk that you'll actually be able to finance it once it's gone unconditional.
The other side of the coin is, I hear you, Brendan, no problem. I'm going to go and find a money partner first. I'm going to find a JV partner first. Great. So you go out, you trottle amongst all the people and friends that you've got, you throw thoughts out there, you plant seeds, and someone comes up with, yeah, okay, I'm interested. What have you got?
Cricket.
I will have a deal shortly.
I don't really know what it's going to be,
but it'll be great.
Right. So it leaves you with a big black hole about answering the question, well, what have you got? So you actually need to work the relationship for a long period of time to build the trust, build the reliability, build the faith, and then demonstrate to your partner that you're committed to the follow-through, you're not going to run off to the Bahamas with their money, and that you can do the job you say you're going to do. So you got to, it takes time to evolve that relationship to a point of trust. You also simultaneously then need to look for deals in the process, show them the deals you're looking at and rejecting. So you reject all the ones that aren't so great and go for the cream, and you'll build trust with your money partner. So you've got to almost work these two things simultaneously. However, what you're doing is establishing a system that's going to allow you to repeat over and over and over again relative to the amount of money that the JV partner or money partner's got. And if you deliver a great deal, they're going to be keen to stay with you because they get money for nothing, which is a win-win scenario. You get to keep going with your investing. You're doing it full-time. You don't need a job anymore. They're funding the deals for you, and you're delivering profit to them. Win-win-win, and you just keep going. Financial freedom for you isn't necessarily far away.
Oh, but Brendan, if I bring on a money partner or a joint venture partner, then I've got to share the profit, and I'll only get half as much, or if I'm giving interest to a money partner, I'm going to get less.
And it's fair enough, too. When I first started, it was two things. I liked the size of the profit that I was going to get for the deal, and I didn't want to have somebody else's financial position as my responsibility on my shoulders. They were the two primary concerns for me. If I did a bad job, someone else is going to lose with me, and I didn't like wearing that responsibility, and I was happy to have all the profit myself. And these were the start.
Fear and greed.
Fear and greed. But I found that I actually didn't have the capacity to go into these deals consistently one after the other. And if that's your case where you can't keep going on deals one after another, you've got to build enough trust and confidence in yourself that you can make it happen and that you can wear the responsibility with your JV partner, but be willing to let go. Otherwise, you stop dead. Mm. You know, that's the old adage. Do you want 100% of nothing or 50% of a huge sum of money? Well, I'll tell you, I'm more than willing to go 50% of a huge sum of money time and time again.
Right.
Particularly if I don't need to be employed or can give up what I hate right now doing to do what I want to do and love doing, and it allows me to get paid consistently over a period of time. It's a win-win-win.
That's right. As Brendan said, you know, it's far better to get something and to move forwards than to be stuck in a rut going nowhere and earning nothing. So, you know, take a moment to think about your own circumstances and the fears or the resistance that you might feel internally to going down the path of a JV partner or a money partner, and ask yourself, well, how real is that? What are you actually prepared to do in the light of your financial goals to help make your financial goals happen sooner?
So let's go back to some basics. Simon, what actually is a money partner and how does a money partner system work?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think a lot of people confuse the two and think that they're one and the same, and they really aren't. They're quite different. A money partner is essentially a private loan arrangement. Cash is advanced and some sort of interest payment is made on that cash. So think going to the bank and getting a personal loan, exactly the same sort of structure but with a private individual. They're going to give you cash, you're going to pay them interest. A joint venture, on the other hand, involves a share in the deal. So there's an element of ownership. There's an element of profit sharing. There's a higher degree of risk sharing. So the joint venture is really that. It's a joint arrangement between two parties to share in the deal and essentially to do the deal together.
So can we go back to money partners for a second and give me some parameters here? Because you said, you know, if I was to knock on your door, Simon, and ask for a money partner agreement,
I'd tell you where to go. Yeah,
you would say, sure thing, Brendan. I'll give you any amount of money you want, and you pay me 2%
per day.
Hang on. But why? You know, why is it that you want 2% per day? I mean, banks are doing what, 6%. You're going to get some money. Stop your whining. Just hand over the cash. What?
Show me the money.
I mean, you want in?
Give me the money.
So, you know, tell me the parameters of how money partner agreements generally are held together.
Sure. Well, let's take a look at why you would do a money partner agreement versus a joint venture for starters. A money partnership arrangement, because you're really after cash, your need is one of capital, actual dollars. It's not about necessarily your borrowing capacity. So let's say you've got a good income. Okay, I can go out and potentially get a loan, but oh, where am I going to get the deposit from? So you need cash. That would put you more in the camp of wanting to get a money partner versus a JV partner. On the flip side, a joint venture is going to be more appropriate when you need somebody to share a greater degree of the risk. So they need to share in the exposure to the loan, for example. They're going to help you get the bank loan. They're going to sign the loan themselves or they're going to co-sign it with you. That lends itself more towards a joint venture partner. Or if you've got a skill gap or a time gap, that pushes you into the area of getting a partner in who can plug that gap, more of a joint venture partner. But taking the money partner side of things, typical workings of this. You typically own the property, so you will have title over the property under a money partnership arrangement. You'll retain title. You go out and source the borrowing. You get the first mortgage. You sign the loan documentation with the bank to get a mortgage to purchase the property. Your money partner simply provides cash, just dollars in the bank. They don't sign your loan documentation. They just provide you with a lump sum of cash. Now, in exchange for that, you probably agree to pay them some amount of interest. And we'll talk a little bit about what that might be, but they also might want some sort of security. So the money partner often, but not always, receives a second mortgage over the property. So your bank would have the first mortgage. They get the first right to foreclose on you if you stuff it up. But your money partner might say, well, look, yeah, I'm a bit nervous in coming into this. I'd like to have some security behind the loan that I'm going to give you for $20,000. I'd like a second mortgage over the property.
So, second mortgage. So how do they get a second mortgage? I mean, they don't generally come in the post.
No. So let's talk about the way mortgages work as security. You've got a first mortgage, which is always in favor of the bank. And that first mortgage means that the bank has the first right to the asset, the property, in the event that you default on the loan. So they can foreclose on your property and take it away and sell it off to get their loan back. A second mortgage is like a first mortgage. It's the same sort of thing. There's a right to access the asset of the property, but because it's the second mortgage, it queues up behind the first in order of priority. So if something does go wrong and your money partner decides, hey, you haven't paid me in 3 months, I'm going to initiate a foreclosure on your property, which they can do as a mortgage holder, then the first thing that has to happen is the bank has to get paid out their first mortgage. Anything that's left over after the bank's mortgage is paid out and any costs due to the bank are paid out, the remaining equity in the property, if any, then comes back first to pay the money partner what they're owed. And then only if there's something left over after that do you get any money back. So it's almost as good as a first mortgage, but not as good as a first mortgage, and certainly better than being unsecured. Now, what is a second mortgage? Well, a mortgage itself is really a one-page piece of documentation. It's just a single sheet of paper. Your lawyer or the mortgagee's lawyer or the money partner's lawyer will go and create the document, fill in the blanks, and can potentially register it against the title of the property as a form of security. And you don't really need to get too hung up on the paperwork side of this. That's why you have a lawyer involved in these transactions.
So the back of a serviette's not enough?
Not quite. Probably an IOU, probably not as good either. Now, you don't necessarily have to give a second mortgage over the property to a money partner. You might have personal guarantees. Certainly I've done it in both ways. When I've engaged money partners, some, particularly when they know you and they've had some confidence through past experience with you, might be okay not having a second mortgage and just you putting up a personal guarantee. On the other hand, if you've never met the person before and they're a bit nervous, they expect that they'll want some sort of security.
Two things. People want security because they want to know that they're going to get their money back. You know, if I tapped on Simon's door and said, Simon, I want $100,000 at 2% per annum, and you'd say, well, not happy with the return, but what security have you got over the fact that you're going to pay me back? And I say, I'm a good bloke, and you go, yeah, sure thing. I've seen your good bloke stuff before. You know, you've got to provide something that, like collateral, like pawnbroking. If you take something to a pawnbroker for cash, they're going to hold some sort of collateral that you own, some item of belonging that represents some sort of wealth to you as a form of security, so that if you don't pay it back, at least they've got something in equivalent value or similar. Well, the second mortgage is a form of securing the borrowing, the securing the lending that you are taking from the money partner. A personal guarantee, great, I said I will, and here's a piece of paper that says I will. Well, excellent, yeah. But there are limitations to that. Other forms of security, a caveat might be drawn over the property. Simon, now, any other forms of security?
Well, let's talk about a caveat. A caveat in and of itself is simply Latin for warning. It's just the Latin word for warning. Now, a caveat on the title stops somebody else from selling the property out from underneath you, and it potentially stops anyone refinancing against the property, so taking out another loan against it.
Sorry, you said stops anyone from selling the property underneath you. How does that...
Okay, so let's say I'm the money partner and I advance $20,000 to Brendan Kelly, who's going to go off and buy this property, and rather than saying, Brendan, I want a second mortgage over the property to protect my interest, I say I just simply put a caveat on the property. I put this warning on the property.
So that I can't sell it without you knowing.
So if you want to try and sell the property without paying me back, you can't, because as soon as you try to settle that sale, this caveat will show up at settlement and you can't transfer a title unless it's cleared, which means cleared of all caveats. So it's an obstruction. It means that someone has to come to me and ask me to remove that caveat first before the property can be unsold. It doesn't give me the right to foreclose on your property if you don't pay me. So it's not as strong as a second mortgage, but at least it provides a layer of protection.
So, all right, let's talk about then the three forms of security, your second mortgage, your caveat, and a personal guarantee. Each of them attract, obviously, different risks. Now, given that investing is all about a risk-reward ratio, as a second mortgagee, what would the percentage return be expected to you who has lent me the money, given that banks are now charging around 6%?
Well, second mortgage rates, if you look at what's out there in the marketplace, are typically in the double digits. So draw a parallel with what you might pay on a personal loan if you were to go and ask for a personal loan. And that's not too far off average. I hesitate to use the word normal because there's no such thing in these arrangements. It's all negotiable. But average money partner rates would be double digit, probably at the moment somewhere between 12 and 18%.
Now, that's as a second mortgage. As a caveat, therefore, you have less security over the property. Would you want to take more or less interest? And if you wanted more or less interest, what value would you anticipate?
Yeah, well, because these things are always negotiable, part of it will depend on the individual that you're dealing with. But it's a fair enough assumption that the less security that you offer, the more you might need to offer in the way of an interest rate return in order to attract the money. If it's seen as riskier because there's less security, well, it's natural for an investor to want a higher return to justify that risk. It wouldn't be right to say that, you know, if you're putting up a second mortgage, you should expect to only pay 12%, or if you're going only so far as a caveat over the property, it'll be 14%, and if it's personal guarantees, it's 18%. It doesn't work that way. What you would do, as per any negotiation, is start by asking the person what they want. What would they like as a return? What would they be comfortable with as a level of security? And then you can play a bit of a game with the risk-reward spectrum. And if they want a higher interest rate, well, offer less security. If they want a lot more security, it's going to be cumbersome in terms of legal fees and putting things on and taking things off the title, then maybe you'll offer a lower return. You trade the two off and find a happy medium.
So the point here is that we are talking about a sliding scale of risk and reward. The more security, the lower the ability to have, or the lower reward, because you're sharing some of the risk. The higher the risk for the money partner, the higher the reward for the money partner. So don't be too tight or stingy. The deal doesn't happen without the money partner, and be willing to share depending upon what the money partner's request may be.
Yeah. Now, what should you be prepared to pay up to? Well, really, it's a question of what options do you have for funding and what will your deal bear and still provide you with an acceptable level of profit. So start from that position, figure out what your negotiating position would be as a result, and just negotiate from there. Find out what the other person wants.
All right, so let's go to the other end of the deal then. And I've gone away and I've taken your $100,000 and we've agreed on an interest rate of, what, 45%?
Why not?
And let's be reasonable. Let's say about 12.
Say it's 12%.
Yep, all right. So I've taken your $100,000. I've got to pay you 12.5%. We've agreed that it's a one lump sum payment at the end of the deal, that you get it back and it's within a year. La-di-da-di-da, it's all beautiful, and you've got a personal guarantee from me because I'm a good bloke that I'll pay you back. And I knock on your door on the 31st of December and I say, Simon, mate, I know some money's due to you. The deal didn't quite work out as well as I'd hoped. How about I don't pay you as much interest? Do I have the right to do that?
Oh, look, you can always ask, right? And if you ever do find yourself in a position like that, then you know, you want to try and work out a solution that's going to be ultimately a win for everybody, or at least solve the problem. However, what you need to realize with a money partnership agreement, as you would with a personal loan from the bank, is that you're obligated to make repayments in line with whatever terms have been negotiated, regardless of the success or failure of your deal. You owe money and you have an obligation to meet the contractual terms of the loan agreement.
So not only do I have to pay it back, I have to pay you back with full interest and a smile on my face.
Whatever the terms of the agreement say, exactly. So if it had been you've got to make monthly repayments of principal and interest to me, then you've got to make those monthly repayments of principal and interest in line with the loan agreement. If it was all at the end when the property is sold and you happen to sell it at a loss, too bad, you've still got to come up with all the money that you owe me plus the interest that you owe me. So you must pay your partner regardless of the profits under a money partnership agreement.
So the implication then is that I'm actually in control of the deal because you're a money partner, you're silent, you're at a distance.
I don't want to know about the deal. I don't want to know about the detail of the deal potentially other than to satisfy myself that you're an okay risk. All I want to know is that I'm being paid on time, what I should be paid, when I should be paid it.
And I go off and I go and play my Mary Hardaway and hopefully deliver on the profits that I'm after so I can satisfy the obligations that I've put in place with other people and money partners.
That's correct. So you would control and manage the deal with little if any input from the money partner.
So how does that then vary from a JV agreement? Because obviously that's the other side of the fence where you and I play the game together.
Yes, so a joint venture partnership is quite different. In this case, the title of the property or ownership of the property is generally held either just in the partner's name, so you might not actually have any ownership over the property, or more commonly it's held jointly or within some jointly controlled structure, say a unit trust or a company that's being used for the investment. Finance is either sourced by your partner themselves and they write the loan or they put their name on the loan, or it's done jointly. And again, most commonly all directors of any joint venture entity will be guarantors on the loan or co-signatories on the loan. Now, remember, you're engaging a joint venture partner because for one of the primary reasons why you would be because you cannot get the full amount of finance required yourself. So you're bringing them on and you would either get them to source the finance or you'll source it jointly together.
Or in other circumstances, they have a skill that has a bearing that you don't have a skill for, etc.
Yeah, correct. Now, because there's joint involvement, the returns are shared. So there's a profit share. Now, that might be 50-50, it might be 70-30, it's all negotiable. But most joint venture agreements between two parties, and remember you can have more than two parties involved here, but if it was just two parties, most joint ventures tend to gravitate towards a 50-50 profit share because it's hard to justify or articulate or quantify a different sharing. How do you quantify someone's ability to go out and find and put together the deal and the time that they invest in managing the deal versus someone else's ability to go out and finance and fund the deal? Is that equal? Is that somehow not equal? And should the percentages be adjusted? Unless you can justify and with evidence some reason why it should be different, it's very hard to gravitate away from that 50-50 split.
So there are some basic approaches, basic rules of thumb to begin the negotiation process with. Don't go in greedy is the first point, but have a think about this. If you're the time partner, you cannot make a deal happen without money. If you're the money partner, you cannot make the deal happen without time and skill. So if you've got someone with time and skill and someone with money, then you're talking about a 50-50 split. You're talking about sharing profit 50-50. Okay. That's one extreme. The other extreme is someone's got enough money and enough time and enough skill to do half the deal. The other person's got enough money, enough time, and enough skill to do the other half of the deal. You put in each amount the same of money, each amount the same time, each amount of different skills, but they're equatable. That quite obviously then becomes a 50-50. So the relationship, the outcome of 50-50 can vary between someone's all money and someone's all time to half time and money each. All right. Everything else is some sort of relationship in the middle. Now, when do you veer away from a 50-50 JV agreement? Well, say, for example, you're the time partner, you've got the skill and the time, and you've got about half the money you need. Hmm. Then you might want to consider a money partner agreement versus a joint venture agreement. But if you need loan documents signed and you need support for funding this thing, then you might say, all right, you go to your JV partner. Simon, I'm coming to you as my JV partner. I say, Simon, listen, mate, love you, bloke, but we don't need to go 50-50 in this because I'm putting half the money in and all of my skill and time will go into making this happen. I'm going to make you a pile of dollars. Let's go 25%.
Yeah.
All you need to do is sign the loan documentation and give me half the deposit and we're fine. So it's a low cash position for Simon. He doesn't have to put a lot of money in. Low risk or medium risk situation for Simon. He only has to sign 50% of the loan, let's say. I'm putting in the rest. Therefore, I can go to Simon and say, how about we go 25-75? Where I give you 25% of all profit, or we share risk, you share 25% of the risk, I have 75% of the risk.
Now, is 25% on my part fair and reasonable? I might think it is, or I might think it isn't. But the point here is that it's all negotiable, right? You need to look at, again, how badly do you need the money? What sort of a profit share are you prepared to give up and still be happy to move forwards with the deal so that you know your bottom line position? And then you negotiate from there. You try and figure out what's the other person going to accept and where can we meet at some point where everybody is happy.
But again, I flag the whole greedy thing. Don't be greedy. The reason I suggest you're not greedy is so that, well, just be aware, this deal won't happen without you. This deal is not going to occur without a money partner or a joint venture agreement. So you're going to forego a whole pile of profit and a whole pile of progress in your wealth creation if you get greedy on sharing.
Mm.
So be willing to share. And one final point, which we'll probably get into more depth next week, is if you come into a joint venture agreement with, this is what I want to get out of it, this is what I want, and it's all about me taking what I want, and I'll give you the rest, it's not the right perspective, and it leads to battles.
Mm.
You want to avoid battles. I want to be in it so that Simon wins.
Mm. You need to be fostering a good working relationship here, otherwise it's pointless. Your JV will just come apart at the seams.
Of course, Simon wants to be in it so that Simon wins too, but that's a whole other conversation.
Makes the most money possible. All right. So the returns are shared, and to an extent that's often 50-50, it doesn't have to be and can be negotiated. The risks are also shared, and what you'll usually see is that if there's an even sharing of risk, there's an even sharing of reward. So if the JV project fails for whatever reason, so it makes a loss, typically each party will share in the loss to the extent that they would have shared in the profits in the same proportions. So risks are shared.
Let's now talk, if we can, about finding these people. Mm. I mean, it's all great to say philosophically it can happen, but where do people find other people with money?
The idea is that in order to attract other people's money, you've got to have credibility and confidence. You've got to back yourself before anyone else will. That's the fundamental part of it. There's no point in going out and going, oh, I'm going to go look for a money partner, but I'm really uncertain about what I want to do. I don't think I can make a deal happen. Undermine yourself. It'll just come across when you're looking for money partners. So we'll talk more on the next session of this webinar around really getting the commitment from money partners. But for starters, you've got to establish some credibility. Now, track record obviously carries weight. So there is a high value for experience. So if you can show that you've done successful deals before, or you've completed other JVs or money partners agreements before successfully, then obviously that's going to carry weight, and that will make it easier for A, you to portray yourself with credibility, and B, to actually find other money partners. But what if you lack experience? What if you're just starting out and you've identified a need for a money partner or a joint venture partner? So you haven't got a lot of deals, or perhaps haven't got any deals under your belt yet. What do you do? Well, I remember facing this in the early days of my own investing myself. You know, we're no different from anyone else. You start off, you do a deal or two. Oh, hey, I've run out of money. I'm tied up on other projects. What am I going to do? I can see some good deals out there that I want to do. What am I going to do? And you go out there looking for money partners, and they say, you talk to someone, and they say, so what have you done before? Oh, well, I bought this property over here, and I've done this property, so I've got a couple of deals under my belt. And they go, come back to me when you've got a couple of dozen more. Now, that's a risk, and that's a fear that most people will have. How can I be credible as a good risk if I don't have a lot of experience. And that's where you've got to look at the merits of the deal itself. So if I don't have a lot of experience to say, well, trust me because of my track record and here it is, here's my CV of property deals, can you excite your prospective partner about the merits of the deal itself? Here's a really exciting deal that I'm looking to do. I just need to figure out some way to make another $40,000 to put into this deal and then it's all good to go. But the return's fantastic and we've done our research and blah, 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 blah. It's a really exciting deal. So you go to the merits of the deal. You show that you have demonstrated, you've done good due diligence, that you've checked out your valuations, that you know what your incomes and cash flows are going to be, and that the returns in the deal seem really good. You present that with confidence. Now, if you believe in the deal, if you're excited about the deal, that will come through in the way you talk about the deal. And it's natural. You don't have to have pre-prepared a five-minute speech about your deal with a whole lot of slides and a folio of information. You just dive straight into it and you present with confidence and your excitement will rub off on the other person. I mentioned due diligence. You need to demonstrate the due diligence that you've done. So you need to be confident that your due diligence is good, that it hasn't got massive gaping holes of unvalidated assumptions. So same as if you were going to go into the deal off your own finances, except that you are involving somebody else and therefore there is a risk to their funds as well. But you need to demonstrate that you've done the due diligence. Have you crunched the numbers? Have you checked your figures? Do you understand what the market in the area is doing? Do you know your end sale values? Demonstrate your due diligence. Show that it's been done. If you've got skill gaps, so let's say you've never constructed a four-unit development before and that's the nature of the deal, obviously you might get asked the question, so have you ever built a four-unit project before? Well, no, I haven't. A better answer is, well, no, I haven't. That's why I've engaged this builder over here who does these sorts of deals all the time, and here's some examples of their work and their history. You plug the skill gap. You demonstrate through other people's experience why the risks are well managed. And you can formalize a proposal around all of this as well. So sometimes it helps to actually document the nature of the deal and the nature of the offer to your partner, whether it's a money partner for a fixed interest return or whether it's a joint venture arrangement where there's going to be a profit share. Get it down on paper. Explain the nature of the deal, the status of the deal, the ins and outs of the deal in terms of the risks and how they're being managed and the rewards that are in it for potential partners.
Now, if you're completely green to investing and you don't know the terminology, you don't know how to put a deal together, you don't know how to put a proposal together, well, there's the challenge. Skill up. It doesn't cost anything other than time and energy to build the knowledge and build your wisdom around the language to use, around how things are pulled together or how deals are constructed, and talk to your coach because that's what we're here to do. By now, through a year in the results program and 6 months in the grad program and then some for some people, you've got to have an idea of how deals are pulled together, the number crunching, the critical components, the critical number factors, the things that would interest a potential money partner or a JV partner. What is it that your potential partner wants to see, and how can you then pitch your idea, proposal, thoughts to them that they go, oh, I'm inspired. And you've got to have the confidence to be able to say, I know what I'm talking about. You may not know the finer details, not having ever delivered on it, but you've got to know the language, you've got to know what you're talking about, you've got to be able to speak with confidence. You need to, through the tone of voice and the way you deliver this proposal, have the confidence such that they build trust in you to say, oh, well, he talks strongly and he seems to know what he's talking about, and I know I don't know what he's talking about, but that's okay, he does, and that's what I'm paying him for. That's what I'm giving my money to him for. So your role, skill up here so that you speak with confidence and you speak the language.
Now, that's vitally important to be out there with your investing. So as Brennan said, you want to speak with confidence, but it means that every time you've got an opportunity to talk about your investing, you should be taking it. I recall in one of the past programs talking with a lady, one of our members, who was very insular with her investing. She's very reluctant to talk about it. And so she'd go to dinner parties or social events and people would ask her what she did, and she'd talk about her day job. She would never talk about the actual property investing that she was doing, which was reasonably substantial. And it was to her detriment that she did that, because if people don't know about your investing, how can they get engaged in it and become excited about it and become a potential partner? If you've got hang-ups around talking about money, it's time to let those go. You need to be loud and proud with your investing. So every opportunity you've got, you want to talk about it. You want to be excited about it. If someone asks you, what do? Don't mention your day job. Just say, I'm an investor, or I'm a property developer, and these are the sorts of things we're doing at the moment. If they try to shut you down, or if you get the body language of crossed arms across the chest, or the money is evil hang-ups from that person, that's fine. Change the topic, move on to a different conversation with a different person. But if you're not out there constantly talking about your investing, you are not going to find money partners.
Now, you've started to switch the conversation now into, let's actually go into finding the people. Let's go into finding the people with the money.
Mm.
Simon, where can people start? How do people get it together so that they have a list per se of, I need to phone this person first, I need to phone this person next, and start to build the relationships? Where do they go?
Sure. Making a list is a great starting point. So sit down, take some time out later today and make a list of everyone you know who could be a potential partner. So you're trying to think here, who do I know who might have money or good loan servicing ability, so good income, who I could potentially talk to about this? So, and sometimes it's people you least expect. Now, I don't really necessarily advocate family as money partners, but I remember a few years back I had a deal coming together and I needed to raise about $70,000 for it, and I was thinking about who do I know who might have this money. And I was chatting to my brother at the time, and he's the sort of guy who you look at him, he's the perpetual student. He's over 40 now, but he's a perpetual student. The scruffy beard and the long hair and
patches on his tartan jacket.
Yeah, very much arty, think art student, and that's him to a T. And we were just chatting, and I half joking went, I'm trying to do this deal, and I need about $70,000. Hey, you wouldn't happen to have $70,000 just hanging around, would you? And expecting him to go, you're right. And he goes, funny you should say that. And it
wonderful.
Went from there, and we put together the money partnership agreement. Now,
did you pay him back?
Oh, of course I did. With interest.
With interest.
Now, there's something to remember there with family. Like, if you're sitting there thinking, okay, there are people in my family who might be prospective money partners or joint venture partners here, despite the fact that they're family, if you do want to go down that path, and if it's the way to help you move forwards, and it may be for some people a key way to move forwards, then it's still got to be done as a business transaction, arm's length, properly documented by lawyers so that everybody's protected, everybody's rights and obligations are well known, and everybody goes into the deal with their eyes wide open to the risks, not simply on a handshake, oh, you're my brother, I love you, I'm sure it'll be fine. There's a saying that says you can't clean up blood with money. And it's very true when it comes to financial arrangements with family. So you want to be very cautious about using family. If it's your only and key way forwards, okay, but just be very careful about the way you put it together.
So all relationships that you're going to go into have risks.
Correct.
But if let's work on the people that you can potentially get involved with. So starting from the top, you've got family. They're usually the ones that are closest to you and have built up and grown up with you. Therefore, there's an element of trust. Friends, long-term friends, short-term friends, but people who have a relationship, some sort of click with you that allows you to know them personally as well as professionally, potentially.
You may have a fairly clear idea of their financial situation. Again, same risks as with family. There's a relationship there that transcends the business relationship you need to be mindful of, you need to be careful of.
Workmates, people, peers in the office of a potential. You could go to people that you engage, such as accountants, lawyers, mortgage brokers potentially, doctors, dentists. There's a number of other people you can go to, but
high income, people who are typically in high income positions who might not have a lot of time but might be interested in doing something with their money.
But task one is just get a list down.
Mm.
Create a list of as many heads in your life as possible that you feel have the potential for money, feel have the potential to have enough cash flow, have enough potential cash behind them, to be able to offer you support financially for a reward that's going to keep them happy.
Mm.
Get your list first. Then part of that after you've got your list is to go down and say, right, what are the risks, both personally and emotionally, as well as financially and relationship-wise, and make an assessment whether you're willing to put that relationship at risk.
Yeah. Now, I was chatting to one of the guys in the program just the other day about some of this, and he's been out starting to be very loud and proud about his investing, and it's paying off in terms of people materializing and saying, well, I might be interested in coming in on a deal. His boss actually has gone, you know what, maybe we should do a deal together, which is, that's great to have that relationship. You always need to be mindful, though, of the conflict of interest in those sorts of situations. So you're in a deal together and you're not performing at work. How does that work in the relationship? You know, the boss is torn now between, well, this guy's making money for me, or we're making money together, but he's not doing what I want him to do in the office during the working hours, or he's starting to use working hours to work on this deal that I'm involved in. You can see how it becomes very tangled and
the ugliest case scenario, you've got your boss and you're working there and the deal's not going so well.
You're fired.
Well, that's it. You not only lose money in the deal, you've lost your job as a result.
Yes, so you know, that. It's not to say that relationship can never work. It comes down to the individuals involved, but you need to be very mindful and make conscious assessments of the risks involved here.
So as an idea in your list, go with the people you know first who know you, because there's already an established trust. There's always already an established relationship. However, outside of that, you can start to work on people that you may not know so well as those you've engaged for fee-for-service things. Now, the sort of people that you may want to approach are people that are highly paid, self-employed type people. Now, a lawyer or a doctor or a dentist or even the owner of a plumbing business or a business owner potentially, if they don't work, money doesn't come in. These people have a pile of cash, but they have no time. And they have no time because their business, their income relies on their presence. And without their presence, there is no income and their family suffers and then the wife has a go or the husband has a go. So they need to maintain that existence. They've dedicated their lives to this particular specialty. Well, these are the people who are often desperate to get out of what they're doing, often desperate to find a solution to the problem of, I'm stuck in this never-ending treadmill of coming to work and delivering on my services based on my own specialty skills. They're the people that you potentially want to tap on the door of and say, hi, I might have a solution for you.
Yeah, and even if they love what they do, they may be sitting on a lot of money that they simply don't have the time to actively invest, and they're looking at it getting 5% in the bank and thinking, maybe I could do a lot better than that. And you may be able to provide them with an opportunity.
Now, does that mean that you can knock on the door and say, hi, my name's Jeffrey, I've just come here and I want to borrow $100,000 and I'll give you a whopping 11% interest and I'll give you a personal guarantee because I'm a lovely bloke, and come into my 4-unit development with me. There's at least $20,000 profit in it, and you can have 10 of that.
I'm trying to picture myself turning up to my chiropractors tonight and with a bound proposal under my arm and going, hi, I know I'm here for you to work on my back, but would you mind taking a look at this? It's not going to work. You know, it's false, it's forced, it's awkward, it's unnatural, and it creates an immediate suspicion and cynicism, I think, in the person. So you have to figure out when and where you can get in touch with these people in a more natural, relaxed context to then put some investment into the relationship. You know, meet with them, give them a call. Get a conversation going about a mutually interesting topic that you know they're okay with, or that in fact is the reason why you have the relationship with them to begin with. So your accountant, for example, it's tax time, I'm going to sit down and we're going to go through the books. Now you're already in conversation, so you can start to talk about your investing and start to drop into the conversation the idea that, you know, you're looking to branch out and start to partner up with more people and see what the reaction is.
Another way, if it's a fee-for-service person such as your chiro or a physio or a doctor or a dentist, you may, as an idea, if your teeth are needing some love, over a period of months go every fortnight and you start a conversation about what you do. They say, you know, they're looking to obviously fill the time while they've got their hands in your mouth, and as best as you can speak with fingers between your cheeks, that it might be appropriate if to start the conversation about what it is that you're doing. And they, in fact, may come to you with, now that's interesting.
But, you know, in my experience, this is what works, right? Just being, again, being loud and proud about your investing, and that means any networking opportunity or any discussion that you've got with somebody who could be a prospective partner, if you're looking for prospective partners, make sure that you're talking about what it is that you actually do with your investing. Otherwise, they'll never know. And if you try and force it on them, it'll be awkward and strange, and that'll immediately put them on the back foot.
All you need to do is talk about what you're up to, talk about it with an enthusiasm, with a vibrance, with a certain joy and excitement, and they'll be inspired to listen about what you're up to and want to know more. And when they start to ask questions about what it is you're in, then they're engaged in the conversation, and it's just a matter of speaking to what you do. What you can do, though, is say, hi, this is what I'm up to. This is what I'm doing. This is the phase I'm up to right now. And the next part of my phase requires more money than I've got available to me. Ah, well, let's just keep going. I'll see what happens. Now, by putting the words out of this is what I'm up to and this is what's happening and this is the problem I'm facing right now, astute people with money will say, maybe we should get down for a coffee or have a phone call and chat. And once they're engaged, you then start to evolve the conversation into, well, what my needs are and what the returns may be and stuff like that.
Exactly. Now, I often get people saying to me, look, I've tried to make a list of potential money partners, but I just don't know anyone with money. Now, I think everybody knows somebody with money, but if you feel like there's just nobody in your circle or nobody that you could go to out of that list immediately and actually approach about these sorts of things, well, what do you do? Well, let's spend just a couple of minutes quickly looking at some suggestions that are out there from other commentators and other so-called gurus in the property world. I remember years ago, and I'm pretty sure, Brennan, you've got the same product as well. But
It's changed in 5 years.
Yeah, I went to a seminar by one of the investor educators out of the US, John Burley. I have a great deal of respect for John. I think his stuff's fantastic. And part of a package that I bought of his, and this is all part of the importance of investing in your education, we always do it, and I'm constantly continuing to educate myself with other people's content as well. But I bought John's stuff, and there was a section in one of his manuals about finding investing partners. I thought, great, let's have a read of this, and it might give me some tips. And this was back in the days when I was needing money partners myself. And I went through it, and there were these five techniques for finding money partners. I thought, wow, not one technique, five techniques. Fantastic. Oh, surely there'll be something in here that'll work for me. And I went through them. And let's take a look at some of those techniques now and think about how this works in your mind here in Australia or New Zealand or wherever you're listening to this from. The first one was to use direct mail. So you would go and get a list of members of a professional association. So you'd find some website for doctors and download their list of members and then look up those people and try and direct mail them, or go around doctors' surgeries and leave letters in their mailboxes saying, hey, I'm Brendan Kelly and I have this fantastic investment opportunity and here's all the details and if you're interested, give me a call. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, if I get unsolicited mail trying to sell me into an investment scheme, what's your reaction?
Yeah, I'd expect a low hit rate on that, actually. You know, 1,000 things might get maybe one inquiry with a very skeptical perspective, but you know, the odds are you don't get a big return on your time of throwing that out. However, that one inquiry may convert. That one inquiry may give you the money you need to make multiple hundred thousand dollars.
So you could try playing the numbers game of putting out dozens or hundreds, maybe even thousands of letters to try and find potential partners. But there's another little gotcha here. And if the issue is that if you say the wrong thing in this letter, so if you promise a specific return or you're seen to be advertising an investment product of some form without the necessary prospectuses and compliance documentation that ASIC, the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, would want you to have to advertise such products, you could be in a world of trouble. You could be fined. You could even have jail time if you've done the wrong thing. So it's somewhat more restrictive here than it is in the States to do this kind of stuff, and I would say not really a great return on investment of time.
Needless to say, the world has shifted significantly in the 5 to 10 years since this product was actually produced, and the world in Australia is somewhat more consumer protection oriented than it was back then. So, yes, according to ASIC, putting percentage returns or anticipated returns without the full disclosure of what the product is or what you're trying to sell brings out a huge risk of prosecution. Mm. So don't go there, basically. Yep.
And the same could be said for technique number two that was in this list, and that was cold calling people. So again, you'd start with a list of people in a professional association or anyone else that you could add to the list, and you start phoning them up out of the blue. Now, again, I know when I get a call out of the blue at home, even though I'm on the do not call list, and I get a call out of the blue with somebody who I've never heard from before saying, hey, have I got the deal of a lifetime for you? I'm going to promise you a 15% return with no risk. It sets the hairs on the back of my neck. Check on end.
Check.
That's right.
Check.
And, you know, I can't hang up the phone fast enough, usually with a torrent of abuse on the way.
It's like those phone calls you get at dinner time where they ring up and say, oh, hang on, it rings, you pick up, long pause, knowing that it's coming from a whole other
country. Call center.
Yeah. Hi, you've just won a holiday for 5 nights to such and such, and all I need are your details, and we'll send you the airplane tickets. And you're going, you know what? Don't know what the catch is? Not interested. Clunk. Yeah. And it's the same scenario.
You know, people these days are much more sensitive from the point of view of privacy. How did you get my number? Oh, I got it off this list of this professional association. Why have you got that number? What, you know, it makes people very suspicious, and I think you're on a hiding to nothing on that approach here in Australia and New Zealand as well. Again, ASIC issues can come in if you say the wrong thing, so there's a lot of downside risk and a lot of effort and energy and negativity likely to be expended in that approach. Let's move on to the third suggested technique, newspaper ads. So getting into the classifieds and saying, I'm looking for a money partner, I'm looking for an equity partner. You do see this. If you open up one of the major city papers and go into a section that's usually headed up money in the classifieds, you'll often see little 2 or 3 line of classified ads saying, equity partner wanted for development project.
Or you actually may get money available, call me now, sort of stuff for money partner projects or for money partners offering cash for short-term needs.
Beware loan sharks and broken legs.
Well, outside of that, beware very, very high interest rates and people looking to milk off desperate people.
Sure. So again, with newspaper advertising, it's another potential channel. Some people have tried it. I've got some friends who've used it with mixed success. They tell me that, we've managed to score 1 or 2 partners, but we get all sorts of weird and wonderful people coming out of the woodwork that we have to deal with. So there's been a lot of time and energy and filtering involved in that as well. Again, ASIC comes into play, so you've got to be careful about what you say. You cannot offer a specific return, for example. Otherwise, you're in the realm of advertising an investment product. So you need to be very careful. But take a look at what is there in the newspaper and see how other people are doing it.
I used to frequent those pages when I was looking for cash, and I made a couple of calls for a few. They seemed kind of like, don't know they want to play with these people. But I did meet up with someone out of The Age once upon a time to talk about someone who needed some cash for a deal that they were pulling together. And we met up for a coffee and had a conversation around that deal. It seemed to have merit at the time. He wanted more than I was willing to give, but he seemed quite genuine. So there could have been an opportunity out of that for me to do some sort of joint venture partnership. Now, the proposal he put forward wasn't solid enough for me to turn around and say, I'm in. But he had an interesting sort of deal that was going down. So if you can create the deal and pull it together and then throw the ad in the paper and be able to speak confidently to it, there may be people out there who'd be interested in following through on that.
Mm. All right. So, you know, they might not be the most time-efficient approach, and they may be a bit hit and miss, but if all else fails, there's a potential avenue through newspaper advertising. The fourth suggestion put forward in John's stuff was running your own seminars. Now, that's interesting because there'll be those people out there who remember certain property spruikers in recent times who ran their own seminars to sell property, to sell property into deals. Yes, and that some of these people got into an awful lot of trouble and into jail for doing the wrong thing. So, again, it carries a risk. I'd say that running your own seminars or your own networking groups is okay from a networking perspective in terms of establishing relationships that might then evolve into money partner or JV agreements. But it's not okay if you're pushing an investment product, which you may well be seen to be doing if you go straight in there with a prospectus and these are the deals that I'm doing and wouldn't you want to buy in and here's the return that I'm going to offer. You're likely to run foul of ASIC's compliance requirements around advertising or promoting investments. So, again, very dangerous territory. If you want to use that style of approach, of a seminar style or a networking group style approach to try and find money partners, great. Offer content. Offer a networking opportunity for people, an opportunity for like-minded investors to meet and mingle. Don't try to ram your investments down their throat.
No, manage it from a perspective of, now, this is what I'm up to, this is what I'm doing, this is what my needs are right now. Oh, by the way, if anyone wants to chat to me about that, come and see me after the event. And now we have X speaker offering such and such. So all the conversations around any JV or money partner agreements for stuff that you're doing needs to occur offline, off the stage, in the side or later, or just get contact details from people and do one-on-one communication over a coffee. Keep it completely distant from the event that you run, from the networking sessions that you run, from the seminar that you run.
Mm. Indeed. Technique number 5 was referrals from past partners. So if you've had money partners before, they might refer other people to you, which is great. And certainly my own experience, that once you've done one or two money partnerships or JV agreements, it's almost like the floodgates open and suddenly you've got some established track record, some established credibility. People have had a good experience with you. They tell their friends and their friends tell their friends and so on and so on and so on. And you often get contacted out of the blue or one of your past partners comes to you and says, hey, I've got a mate who might be interested. Do you want to talk to him? And that's great. But how do you get the partners in the first place? And that relies really on these 4 prior techniques. And I question really the effectiveness of those prior techniques in the current market and current climate today. So what's the most effective approach? And it's not actually listed in those 5. The most effective approach in my experience, and I think in your experience too, Brennan, is simply networking. It's getting yourself out there. It's pushing your comfort zones a little bit, particularly if you're not naturally a gregarious people person who can just strike up a conversation at the drop of a hat with people they don't know or don't know very well. I know personally that I have historically felt socially awkward about meeting people for the first time, particularly when I was first looking for money partners or JV partners. It was a little bit alien to me. How do I approach this subject without causing offense? Or what do I say that I don't look like a complete idiot? How do I approach it? The key is just to be yourself, but take every networking opportunity that you can. Now, what are some networking opportunities, Brennan? Where might you meet people who might have money?
Well, we've chatted about a number of people that you could resource on. I would say work colleagues would be a great place to start. They're working. They have cash flow. They, therefore, by default, should have some income and some ability to borrow money.
Yeah, you might turn up at 9 a.m. each morning and just to hear how miserable your work colleagues are at work and all the stories about how they hate their job. Well, maybe you've got an opportunity or a potential solution that can help ease their pain. You do need to be selective, I found, in your work-based conversations. So bear in mind that your employer probably has a clause in your contract along the lines of your full-time energies during working hours are to be committed to this job and this job alone. So you do need to be smart about who you talk to.
So you're saying don't go up to the CEO, knock on his door and say hi.
No, let him knock on your door.
Lovely.
Yes. But there'll be people at work that you've got a good relationship with or that you know or that you meet on a project at work that they might ask you, what are you doing? What do you do outside of work? And you can start to talk about some of your investing stuff and see if there's an interest there. Once they've opened the door and expressed an interest, then you can start moving it in the direction of talking about a money partnership.
Investor meetings.
Yes. Now, what are investor meetings, Brendan?
Well, we talked about them earlier, network meetings, and meetings where people gather to talk about their property investing, where people gather to talk about what their interests are and how they can make money through property. We're not talking, what, mothers club meetings and that sort of stuff. That doesn't work. Or childcare meetings. You need specific topics, specific meetings where people are starting to talk money, starting to get their lives sorted around, going forward with their own financial visions. They're the sorts of conversations you want to be able to tap into and walk into those sorts of meetings and network groups.
Yeah, in sales speak, it's almost like walking into a room full of qualified leads or qualified prospects. The people in that room are going to be similarly experiencing the market, the frustrations of finding or not finding deals, the frustrations around finance that you might have encountered. There'll be people there with money and no time. There'll be people there with time and no money. Your job is to find the suitable people with the need that you can meet or that you have that they can meet. So if you're not spending time going to investor meetings, community investor support groups, whatever they might be, then you're doing yourself a disservice. But going to an investor meeting as a participant, as a member of the audience, if you go to one of these meetings and don't talk to anyone, if you go there just to sit there as a sponge and absorb the speakers of the day and whatever they've got to offer and take away any freebies from the night, you've missed the whole point.
I beg to differ on that. People are at different stages at different times in their life, and sometimes it's appropriate for them just to sit and absorb and to grow their wisdom so they can speak confidently about stuff. But
here we're talking about people who are interested in finding a money partner, right?
Correct.
So you put yourself in that environment and all you do is listen to the speakers and you don't try to talk to anyone else. Missed opportunity.
Correct. If you've identified that in order to get a deal, you need some support behind you, these sorts of opportunities are awesome for a resource of like-minded people who are open and familiar with the conversations about money and how the world turns without it.
That's right. So on top of that, look at any associations that you belong to or could belong to. So the profession that you're in, it's likely to have some sort of professional association. Are you a member of that? Do you go to the meetings of that? If not, perhaps that's another opportunity. Dinner parties, barbecues, anywhere where there are people who might have money, who might be interested in getting involved in a deal but don't have the inclination or the time to create the deals themselves, there are always opportunities there. Again, be loud and proud about what you're doing. The conversation is not one of, "Hi, Bob, my name's Brendan. I would love to sell you into my deal. Have you got $50,000 that I can give you a 15% annualized return on?"
Ba-bow.
It's about, "Hey, Brendan, what do you do?" "Oh, look, I invest in property and I'm currently developing this project over here and we're building our portfolio over here. It's great fun." "Oh, really? That sounds interesting. Tell me more. I'm stuck in this dead-end job that I hate, and if I'm not out of that in 10 years, I'll probably kill myself. But tell me more about your life because it seems so much more exciting." And it's surprising how often you hear this. You start up one of these conversations, you talk about the deals that you're doing, and the person turns around and goes, "Wow, I wish I had the time/knowledge/whatever to do that. Sounds really interesting, and it's something I've always wished I could get into." Do you ever partner up with anyone?
Yeah.
And that's the magical phrase that you're listening for, and as soon as that comes on your radar, you know that they have opened the door. You haven't had to force the door open. The door has been opened for you. They're inviting you to walk through.
And it's amazing how many times that actually occurs just in natural conversation. Do you actually play the game with anybody? Like, are you open to talking more about this because it's something I've wanted to get into but never had the chance or opportunity, and you sound like you know what you're talking about, and I'd love to play the game. And suddenly the conversation's off and running. Suddenly you're in with a possible relationship where they've come to you.
Yeah.
And it can happen in one conversation. It can happen after 10 conversations, but happen in one conversation if their radar is equally sparked to how do I get out of what misery I'm facing into something else.
Exactly right. So you just need to give them the opportunity by, again, being excited and confident and proud about what you're trying to do with your investing, whether you've done deals yet or not. It's the excitement that you carry in that'll generate that interest. So it's been a pretty packed webinar. We've gone through a lot of stuff. Hopefully that has given everyone listening to this some real insights into the approach that's worked for us and that we believe will work for you in going out there and finding and engaging prospective money partners and JV partners. part two of this, we'll be looking at, we'll revisit the returns and the risk sharing side of things with the deals, but with a focus on, okay, how do you actually take this from a concept and an agreement that, yeah, we should do something together, to actually getting commitment from the prospective partner? So what's involved in doing that? And we'll look at the critical success factors. What's going to make or break the JV agreement or the money partner agreement? We'll go through all of that. Just to draw this to a close then, I come back to a comment I made at the beginning. Attracting other people's money requires credibility and confidence, and you've got to back yourself before anyone else will. Be loud and proud about your investing, and you'll attract interested people, almost by default, almost without trying. So until next time, guys, we look forward to catching up with many of you at the get-together, and happy investing.
See you, guys.